From Contra Costa College in San Pablo, I'm Michael Krasny. As you can hear, we have a live audience here, and we are delighted to be here at Contra Costa College. And just yesterday, a federal judge temporarily halted President Trump's executive order to freeze federal funding for sanctuary cities, ruling in favor of Santa Clara and San Francisco. In a special broadcast from Contra Costa College, situated at the border of Richmond and San Pablo, both, by the way, sanctuary cities, we'll discuss the ruling and what it means going forward for the Trump administration, U.S. immigration policy, and Bay Area communities. It's coming up on Forum after this news. Live from Contra Costa College in San Pablo, I'm Michael Krasny. And as you hear, we have been given a wonderful welcome here, and we are delighted to be here. What we're going to be talking about in this open hour is a federal judge ruling yesterday in San Francisco, temporarily halting President Trump's executive order to freeze federal funding to sanctuary cities across the country. Judge William Orrick said in his ruling that the Constitution vests spending powers in Congress, not the president. For more on this, we really have to look to whether any city or county that decides to limit cooperation with federal immigration agents doesn't have to fear losing funding. And here at Contra Costa College, which sits on the border of sanctuary cities, San Pablo and Richmond, we're going to discuss what this ruling means for sanctuary legislation on the state and the local level. Mayor Tom Butt of Richmond, which had also filed a lawsuit against the executive order, said yesterday that his community, quote, stands against the divisive immigration policies that do nothing but cause trauma and fear, end of quote. And in one of a series of morning tweets this morning, President Trump wrote, quote, first the Ninth Circuit rules against the ban, and now it hits again on sanctuary cities, both ridiculous rulings. See you in the Supreme Court, end of President Trump's tweet. Joining us, Marisa Lagos, who is a reporter with KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Good morning, Marisa.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you here with us, and also glad to have David Levine here with us, law professor UC Hastings. Welcome, David.
Good morning, Michael, and good morning, Contra Costa College.
And good morning to you. John Joya is also with us here, Contra Costa County Supervisor, who is backing a proposal to make Contra Costa a sanctuary county. Welcome, John Joya.
Thanks, Michael, and it's great you're out here in Contra Costa College. Thanks for all coming out today.
And we're also going to welcome by phone Jessica Vaughn with the Center for Immigration Studies, which is critical of sanctuary policies. And she is with us this morning from Franklin, Massachusetts. You can follow along with today's conversation on Twitter using the hashtag ForumCCC. And Jessica Vaughn, good to have you aboard. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let me begin with Marisa Lagos. Marisa, this lawsuit began, of course, with San Francisco and with Santa Clara, but Richmond is very much in the picture here. This is an injunction that's national. How's it going to affect local? Please.
Well, I think immediately not a ton, because at issue here is whether or not the federal government is able to sort of restrict federal funding to jurisdictions that it deems so-called sanctuary cities. Now, there's no actual legal definition for a sanctuary city under federal law. And the government itself, the administration, the Trump administration, has been a little unclear through both its statements in court, outside of court, and in the executive order about what funding it's trying to go after. And this judge yesterday essentially said what a lot of legal scholars and people I've been talking to expected, which is that law enforcement grants, which have sort of some nexus to immigration enforcement, law enforcement and immigration enforcement have a nexus, can be targeted. And last week, we actually saw Attorney General Jeff Sessions already threatened to do that. He sent a letter to nine jurisdictions, including the state of California, threatening some law enforcement grants. But what the federal government hasn't done since this executive order in January is actually say definitively or in court that any jurisdictions are sanctuary, or say that they're going to take away money from them. And so on the ground, nothing's changing, really.
Actually,
it's a war of words in a way.
We're narrowing the definition of a sanctuary city. There was a meeting just yesterday with a number of mayors, and essentially they were reassuring on this, at least the administration was.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you saw in court last week was the administration's lawyers say that they didn't really argue about that issue, but they did say, look, we're not actually trying to go after all federal funding as the cities were worried about. We're really just looking at these law enforcement grants. I think it issue are some pretty sort of nuanced questions around immigration enforcement here. Yeah, is a sanctuary city just any jurisdiction like the more than 300 nationally that have policies saying we are not immigration police, we will not act as immigration police? Is it just the jurisdictions, which is even more, I think, that say we're not going to detain people on behalf of ICE if they are otherwise eligible to be released because we're worried about actually our own legal culpability? There's been some court rulings that found that those were illegal detainers. Or is it just, yeah, these policy statements? So I think what that means and how the Trump administration interprets it is kind of continuing to morph and change.
Well, David Levine, one thing we learned from this order was that Judge Orrick was willing to use statements that were made publicly by not only President Trump, but also by Attorney General Sessions.
That's quite right. This is becoming a bit of a pattern. You might remember with the first executive order case that came out of Seattle and then the second one out of Hawaii, both of those judges, in looking at the so-called Muslim ban from Muslim countries, did rely on out-of-court statements by the president and by the president's senior advisors. And once again, that was done. And the Ninth Circuit specifically approved that in the first appeal. So those statements are proving to be very, very important in the case.
Well, Reince Priebus said they're going to appeal. President Trump earlier today tweeted that we'll see you in the Supreme Court and so forth. What's the likelihood of an appeal going all the way to the Supreme Court and actually, especially now with a new member of the Supreme Court, going the way the administration wants it to go?
Well, it could go to the U.S. Supreme Court, but I would hope that cooler heads will prevail in Washington because this order of Judge Orrick's is pretty bulletproof. It's a preliminary injunction, but if it went to the Ninth Circuit, I think it's pretty likely that the Ninth Circuit would affirm this order. And at the U.S. Supreme Court, the fundamental problem that they're going to have is getting five votes, and the precedent that Judge Orrick relied on are precedents from a guy named Justice Scalia and Chief Justice Roberts. So it's going to be tough to find five votes to overturn this, I think.
Well, let me actually bring in John Gioia, who's here with us. You want to move the sanctuary status forward to the county level? Why?
I do. And let me just say first, I think it's important to note that this federal court decision was a victory for those of us in local government at cities and counties to pursue the practices that we believe are most effective in keeping our communities safe and making them stronger, and frankly also a victory for policies that bring us together and not divide us. So while there's no one definition for sanctuary city, it really comes down to the concept that there is limited, not no cooperation, but limited cooperation between local law enforcement and ICE officials because we want to build community trust among all of our communities, including our immigrant community, so that they can cooperate with us, they can come for health and social services. We want local government to be viewed in a way that people feel comfortable to go for services. In fact, having a sanctuary policy helps us in public health. An example, we are already getting stories of families, hardworking immigrant families, canceling appointments for mental health and healthcare services out of fear, out of anxiety, out of mistrust. We want those folks coming in for services. We don't want to discourage them. That's why we want to look at some kind of sanctuary policy with law enforcement. Our health and social service agencies in practice already have such a policy. We just recently expanded health care to undocumented adults at the county last week. So we're fine on the health and social service side. We want to work with our sheriff's department to change the relationship between the sheriff's department and immigrant communities.
Well, let's talk about the sheriff's department because there is a contract with the sheriff's department and the U.S. Department of Justice.
Yes. Unfortunately, there is. We are the only county in the Bay Area that has a contract. This was the previous sheriff started this contract back in the 1990s, that it's a contract with the U.S. Department of Justice to house up to 200 ICE detainees at the West County Jail, which is not too far from here, while they're being held for deportation. I think that this contract causes an erosion of trust in the county by immigrant communities. As I said, they don't go and get services that are vital for for everybody because of the perception that there's this cooperation. So I think we pay a price in having that contract. The sheriff gets to decide whether to have that contract. So it's really about, because he's independently elected, so it's about appealing to him the importance of trust being more important than the small amount of revenue that we get as a county from that contract.
John, I have to ask you, because it's come to our attention that there are some who feel that there isn't a free or open enough exchange in terms of feeling safe to oppose the kind of position that you've just outlined for us.
Well, it is true that there are some who often, want to cooperate with those who are in positions of authority, for example, the sheriff. I think it's important, and I think a large part of the Contra Costa community has actually spoken up. I mean, we have community leaders from around Contra Costa County who've spoken out. I see there's some here in this audience today who've spoken out against having this ICE contract, and I think that's the only way we are going to get public officials like the sheriff to see that it has more harm than good for the county.
Well, let me bring Jessica Vaughn in. She's with us by phone from Massachusetts, and she's with the Center for Immigration Studies, which is critical of sanctuary policies. And I imagine you have some dismay or certainly discomfort at this decision by what our president might have called this alleged judge, Judge Orrick. But I'd like to get you, Jessica Vaughn, to respond to what you've just heard. I mean, the idea of ICE wanting felons to be held should be in line, as you see it, with the law.
Yeah, I think it is in line with the law. And I think, actually, I'm not particularly dismayed by this ruling because I don't think it changes much. In fact, I was very happy to read in the conclusion that this judge actually endorsed the idea of holding sanctuary jurisdictions accountable under the definition of sanctuary that appears in federal law, which is 8 U.S. Code 1373, which says that no local government can have a policy that in any way restricts officers from communicating or exchanging information with federal immigration authorities. And the judge basically said the government can go ahead and enforce that even by withholding federal law enforcement funding from those jurisdictions. So I think the sanctuaries are actually celebrating a bit prematurely because there is a process, and it was started about a year ago under the Obama administration in fleshing out what this definition means and what kinds of funds can be withheld and how the government should go about doing it. And so the judge endorsed that process, and I'm sure that the Trump administration is going to continue that process. And in fact, the entire state of California's law enforcement funding under three specific programs is at risk unless they change the policy by June 30th of 2017.
Well, your concern, if I can state it such, is obviously the protection of what you would call illegal criminals and keeping them from being deported. But I wonder what you say to those who feel, you know, these are people who not only are afraid to come forward often in police matters, but also are being protected in other ways in terms of health and so forth. I mean, there are some real humanitarian concerns here that obviously rise up.
Well, the main thing, if communities are concerned about immigrants feeling comfortable to come forward to report crimes or to access services, there are much better ways of doing that than by obstructing enforcement of immigration laws against criminal aliens. The only people who benefit from sanctuary policies are criminal aliens that ICE is trying to deport who are released because of these local policies. If communities want to improve trust, what they ought to be doing is going out into the community and saying, victims of crime and witnesses to crime are never targets for immigration enforcement unless they're also criminals. That's the most positive thing they could do. And you can do that without interfering with the federal government's legitimate mission of enforcing immigration laws, which, by the way, protect all of us in the community.
All right, Marisa Lagos wants in here, our reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Marisa, please.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things I just would note. I think what Jessica's referring to about Section 1373 is this federal law that requires communication between the feds and local law enforcement on these matters. And what the state of California and a lot of these cities say is we do that because when somebody's booked into jails, for example, their fingerprints are automatically sent to the FBI and to Homeland Security. We do communicate with them. Last week, as I mentioned earlier, the Attorney General sent a letter to 9 jurisdictions, including the state of California, saying we will take away in California $18 million in annual law enforcement funding to, I think, 32 counties around the state. And you have until June 30th to respond and prove to us that you're complying with this communication requirement. The state of California believes they do that, and so I would expect they will send a letter saying we do that. And so I think that issue may actually end up in court. I wouldn't be surprised to see if the Attorney General and Department of Homeland Security move forward with trying to claw back those grants, if a lawsuit comes forth, and maybe even that time from the state level.
Well, let me talk a little bit more, David Levine, with you about the chances of an appeal. If it goes to, compared to, say, Judge Watson in Hawaii with the immigration ban, what's the dropping with respect to Muslims coming here, the second one on Muslim ban? How does this stack up against that as you see it?
Well, if I had to argue one of these two for the government, for the United States government, I would rather take on Judge Watson rather than Judge Orrick in the decision yesterday. And here's why. When we look at Judge Orrick's opinion from yesterday, he was dealing with an executive order that on its face is way overbroad. I'm just going to quote the key part of it. But the directive in the executive order from January is to determine that if jurisdictions refuse to comply with the statute we talked about, they're not eligible to receive, quote, federal grants, unquote. On its face, that is just way too broad. And so that it's relatively easy for Judge Orrick to have written an opinion that narrows it down to 1373. And indeed, the U.S. attorney who was representing the United States in the courtroom in front of Judge Orrick said, I don't know what you're talking about with that executive order. We're only talking about 1373. So that one it's going to be tough to appeal that one. We could talk about the immigration order from Hawaii, but let's let
well,
it
no,
stand
Well, no, let me
there.
Actually go to the cut to the chase here. I mean, those oral arguments showed that the executive order was mainly political, didn't they?
Well, the U.S. attorney said, it's just the president on his bully pulpit. And what Judge Orrick said is executive orders have the force of law. If the president wants to speak and to persuade people, he has plenty of ways to do that. He used Twitter this morning. He's got plenty of ways to get on camera. But when he uses the executive order that has the force of law, it's a totally different thing.
So, David, quickly, what can the Justice Department do or not do under this order?
What they can do is they can continue to enforce 1373, and they mentioned 3 statutes where the reason it's legitimate to enforce the receipt of that money is that the localities knew that there were strings attached to that money in advance when they took the money and that they promised to comply with 1373. The problem with the executive order more broadly is that for the president to say, and other grants are also at risk and retroactively invade separation of power with respect to Congress.
You should mention what that order is, by the way, the number that you just gave us.
The executive order?
1373.
1373 is the statute that requires or that stops, it forbids localities from restricting cooperation with ICE, with the federal government.
Let me go back to you, John Joya. I know you want in here.
Yeah, I want to add, I think this opinion actually, while temporary in nature right now, is important because the threat of pulling substantial federal dollars away from cities and counties has had a chilling effect on some cities and counties who would want to pass a sanctuary policy but are concerned that they will lose federal dollars. So if this is resolved ultimately where the president cannot pull back dollars, it will free up more jurisdictions to have sanctuary city and county policies. But I think we have to remember, I mean, the Trump administration there's a false premise, a couple false premises. One, this notion that there is this rampant crime going on in immigrant communities. That is just plain untrue. First of all, there's plenty of good research over the decades that shows that immigrant populations commit crime at a much lower rate than those people in the general population. Second, there's this framing by those who oppose sanctuary policies that they prevent any cooperation between law enforcement and ICE. That is just flat untrue. If someone is a serious offender, local law in the community, whatever their immigration status is, they are arrested and they're taken off the streets. And SB 54, the state sanctuary policy, does have provisions to allow the appropriate amount of cooperation with immigration officials. So I think we have to get back. Those that oppose it are mischaracterizing what these policies are about.
Well, Jessica Vaughn, you oppose it. I'd like your response to what you just heard from John Joya, if you would.
Yeah, Yeah, well, frankly, the Justice Department under Attorney General, former Attorney General Loretta Lynch, disagreed with those statements. And when she and her staff last year determined that California had a sanctuary policy that was inconsistent with federal law, and that's why California was put on notice last year that this $18 million was at risk, and they have until June 30th to change it. That's what local jurisdictions should be looking at and considering. And in fact, if the state is considering an even more egregious sanctuary policy. It's so ironic that this ruling came down in the city where the event that was the catalyst for this whole discussion on sanctuaries happened, when a woman named Kate Steinle was murdered by a man who was released by San Francisco's very egregious sanctuary policy. There's, you know, the federal funding issue is not the only one. There's a human cost to sanctuary policies, and I think it remains to be seen whether members of the community are going to be willing to continue to put up with that cost for the political benefit that some mayors and city councilmen think that they get by enacting sanctuary policies.
And again, Jessica Vaughn is with the Center for Immigration Studies, critical, obviously, of sanctuary policies. We're coming up on a break here. Marisa, I want to go back to you. Marisa Lagos, maybe talk a bit about state laws around sanctuary, how that ties in with cities and counties.
Yeah, so the state several years ago, when there was this debate happening under Obama, which you may remember, Jessica's right. I mean, a lot of people called him the deporter in chief. So it's not as if these sort of clashes between the federal government and state government are entirely new to Trump. There was an act passed at the state level called the Trust Act, which did restrict the ability of local officials to do these detainer of folks in jails if they just for ICE, if they're otherwise going to be released. That was fairly limited in scope. Now we have SB 54 by the pro tem, Kevin DeLeon, which is looking to essentially expand that and say that similar to what we have in a lot of the cities in the Bay Area, that unless somebody has been convicted of a very violent or serious crime in the past, that local law enforcement really cannot hand them over to ICE or cooperate with ICE in their investigations. It also seeks to do a lot of the things that John Gioia mentioned in terms of making other city services and public services protected from immigration enforcement action.
All right, again, we're discussing yesterday's decision by a federal judge temporarily halting President Trump's executive order to freeze federal funding for sanctuary cities. We'd like to invite questions from the audience. If you have a question for our panel, please just raise your hand. We will come to you. And you can also tweet us at KQED Forum or post your comments at our website, kqed.org/forum. Or please feel free to call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. We'll continue our conversation about sanctuary cities, and we'll take your questions and comments. After a short break, please stay with us. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny with a live audience here in Richmond. And we're talking about a federal judge's decision just yesterday temporarily halting President Trump's executive order to freeze federal funding for sanctuary cities. Joining us for the hour is Marisa Lagos, reporter with KQED's California Politics and Government Desk, David Levine, law professor at UC Hastings, and John Gioia, Contra Costa County Supervisor, backing a proposal to make Contra Costa a sanctuary county. And with us by phone from Franklin, Massachusetts, Jessica Vaughn with the Center for Immigration Studies out of Washington, D.C., which is critical of sanctuary policies. Again, please raise your hand here. I'm speaking to a live audience if you have a question. You can also tweet us, KQED. The tweet is KQED at KQED Forum, or you can post comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum. Or call us. Again, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. And you can follow along with today's conversation simply going to Twitter and using the hashtag ForumCCC. Skip writes, the sanctuary policy should be put before the voters. What about that idea? Anybody want to weigh in on that, Marisa?
I was just going to say there was actually some recent polls that showed very strong support of sanctuary policies, and that that's kind of flipped since Trump came into office. So I think that some of this, again, is, you know, do people understand what they are and what they do? But also I think that there's a real sense in California politically right now, which is a very blue state, obviously, that this is one of the major ways that Democrats are pushing back against Trump. And so I think that sort of from that point of view, there's been some shifts. I just want to also respond to one thing Jessica Vaughn said about the Kate Steinle case, which was a really horrific case in San Francisco 2 years ago. I was digging back into that, and I think it's an interesting one that really shows some of the holes in both local and federal law enforcement. The suspect in that case, which has not gone to trial yet, had been deported 5 times by the federal government. He had been in jail, or in federal prison, rather, serving out a sentence for coming back into the country illegally. They transferred him to San Francisco on a 20-year-old marijuana misdemeanor charge, which then never got prosecuted because everyone knows San Francisco doesn't really prosecute marijuana crimes. And so the sheriff at the time had an even stronger policy against any communication with the feds. I think there was a breakdown there. But it also seems that there was a real question about federal immigration enforcement. If somebody can do this repeatedly and come back in and commit crimes and have a criminal record, what is the answer here? Is just putting them back in Mexico or somewhere else the answer?
All right, we have a question from our audience. Mary, join us, please. Welcome.
Good morning. I represent San Pablo Economic Development Corporation that is working to train and educate the workforce and the small local businesses here to improve our economy. We've noticed we run a tattoo removal clinic called Removing Barriers, and we and tattoo removal clinics across the nation have noticed a huge upsurge in clientele who are afraid that their tattoos will be mistaken for gang-related tattoos and that the immigration authorities will pick them up and deport them. I just wanted to comment that there's been, you know, a huge rise in fear evidenced by the sign-ups for the tattoo removal clinics.
I much appreciate that comment. Thank you for it. And I think Mr. Joya, John Joya, has a response.
I was just going to say, I think that that's consistent with what we see with families seeking health and mental health services, that they often will, we have seen specific cases where families cancel appointments. So you're right. That is why policies are important at the local level, which maintain public safety, but at the same time build community trust.
John, can I ask you about money? Because about $2 billion a year funds would be cut out from San Francisco, in turn, that's about a fifth of their budget. Yeah. In Santa Clara, it's about $1.7 billion. That's a third of their revenue. What about Richmond?
Well,
I mean, in terms of the worst-case scenario.
I can talk for Contra Costa. I'm less familiar with Richmond, although I see the chief of staff or the mayor here. But for Contra Costa County, the board I serve on, we have a budget of about $3 billion, and half of that is health care. And that's about $1.5 billion. And most of that are federal reimbursements. So if the president's orders go as far as cutting back federal funding for health care, including Medicaid reimbursements, we'd have to close our county hospital. We'd have to close all our 11 clinics. So it would have huge implications for the health care of all Contra Costans, for the million people that live in this county. So it's significant.
And let me go to a caller. David, join us on Forum. Welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. Where in the Constitution does the executive branch have the right to write laws and control monetary policy?
Let me go to Professor Levine on that.
Well, maybe you'd like a job in the White House to explain things to them. The core of the judge's order has to do with separation of powers and federalism. On the separation of powers side, the issue is that Congress has to determine the strings that might go with particular pots of money, and that the administration, the president can't just override that on the one side. And on the federalism side, it's the 10th Amendment, and the issue there is the fact that the federal government cannot commandeer state and local officials, mandating them to do things, but instead they have to be encouraged with carrots and maybe sticks with the withdrawal of that money, but that it's a different relationship. We have this separation of government, and that needs to be enforced. And by the way, the president, I think, is having dinner with Supreme Court justices this week, and maybe they can have at least an abstract discussion about some of these things.
I wonder if he's going to compel them to eat steak, as he's done on a few other occasions in Mar-a-Lago. Let me bring Jessica Vaughn back into this again. She's with the Center for Immigration Studies. Before Jessica Vaughn, we heard from John Gioia that there is a real sense of concern here in this area about the relationship between the sheriff and the federal government, but I think your polls, and of course there are a lot of people skeptical these days of polls, but your studies have shown the sheriff and police by and large want to help ICE?
Absolutely. 90% of the sheriffs in the country have no problem cooperating with ICE and want to do it, in fact, because they understand that when they don't, that means that criminal aliens that are here illegally that ICE is trying to send home instead get released back to the streets of our communities and often do reoffend. That's the real reason for not having sanctuary policies, and that's the reason why the Sheriff's Association of California was opposed to the Trust Act and why they opposed SB 54, this new proposal to make California an even more obstructive sanctuary. So, you know, they know the public safety benefits of cooperating with ICE to remove criminal aliens from the community. And again, if local governments are concerned about community trust and what they need to do is spread the message that victims and witnesses are not targets for immigration enforcement and get that message out there, because the majority of communities in the country that do cooperate with ICE have found that that actually works much better than having policies that obstruct the legitimate enforcement of immigration laws. And it's important to remember that, yes, Congress appropriates the money, but it's the federal government that writes the check. Congress has said that communities that want federal dollars have to be in compliance with all federal laws. So it's perfectly reasonable and realistic for the federal government to say, especially for DOJ to say, if you're going to obstruct federal law enforcement, we are not going to write you a check for programs that involve federal law enforcement. And that's what's happening here, and that's what California is facing, a cutoff of these funds, and any other jurisdictions that enact sanctuary policies that are a violation of 1373 are going to also face potential cutoff from these funds. Nobody's talking about withholding Medicaid and Social Security. That's a straw man that's been set up.
We should mention here, by the way, that there is a movement to make California a sanctuary state, but thank you, Jessica. It already is, right, theoretically. But let me get a question from the audience. Sarah, you had something you wanted to bring to the fore here. Sarah?
Yes, I'm a Richmond resident, and I appreciate the immigration policy and the decrease in violence in our community over the last 17 years. I have a question for John Gioia. Beyond the rhetoric from the Trump administration, I wonder if there's any behind-the-scenes discussions or access to really work on this issue and try to resolve some of the problems.
When you say behind the scenes, you mean between staff level from federal agencies and local law enforcement?
Yeah, or your office and anyone on staff.
Well, let me say, at any level. I wish I had that access. I wish that at the local level we had that ability. Frankly, I think this administration's policies are pretty firmly set. And frankly, what they do is they create false premises. Like that there is massive crime going on in immigrant communities, or that sanctuary policies prohibit all cooperation. That's just flat untrue. So there's been discussions, but at the state level, they're clearly not successful in trying to move the policies of the federal government. Look, at our local level, I don't think we're considered very important to the Trump administration. And if you look at the other policies outside of this area as well. He's not showing a lot of respect for states' rights, frankly, or local control. So, no, I wish we could say we had more influence, but no, there's no backdoor discussions.
And again, John Joy is Contra Costa County Supervisor, backing a proposal to make this county a sanctuary county. Let me read some of your remarks that are coming to us. Lloyd tweets, I grew up near Boulder, Colorado. They are a sanctuary city. I would never handle myself the same, knowing there are more criminals around. I don't want to be around people who think breaking the law is okay. And Dan writes, I agree with Judge Orrick 100%. You can't threaten to withhold funding just because you don't get your way. That's not how it works. Let me go back to our audience. And Rachel, you have a question or comment.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
My first question, I have two questions, actually. My first one is for John Joya. I'm curious, if we're doing outreach just at the county level to our immigrant and undocumented communities, not only let them know that they're safe to continue to access our resources, but to also communicate that they're valuable. So I'm curious what our outreach efforts look like. And my second question is general, and it's about, so if we as sanctuary cities are being threatened to have funding pulled at the federal level, but beyond law enforcement, what other specifics are we looking at? What other funding is actually vulnerable?
I think where a lot of the outreach is occurring are by the great staff that we have in our health and social service departments within the county who work also with community-based organizations. I mean, we see a lot of families for services and with our community-based partners. And so that contact and outreach is really one-on-one, family to staff to family, where they're assuring them, look, you're going to be safe coming to us for services. So that happens. But people also read, you know, what they read in the paper is, gee, there's this ICE contract or the Trump administration is saying this. All that affects people's actions as well. But we try to assure people, and it's really done through our great staff. We have thousands of employees who serve this whole county, and they're great. What funding? You know, I disagree with Jessica's notion that this can't extend to federal funding on health care. I mean, if the state passes SB 54, it would potentially put at risk funding that comes, healthcare funding that comes through federal funding that comes through the state of California to us. So this is significant. And there's been no clear delineation by Trump about what federal funding he's talking about, which has a chilling effect, and that's the problem. In county government, a lot of our funding is federal funding. Not the case as much with cities, some cities, but counties get health and social service funding that flow. In fact, our Head Start preschool, we run preschool around Contra Costa County. Most of that funding comes from the federal government. We would have to close our preschools, Head Start preschools, if we lost that funding.
Well, first to Professor Levine and then to Marisa. David,
just briefly on the executive order. The executive order speaks of federal grants in general, and one section that was challenged says all federal grant money that is currently received by any sanctuary jurisdiction. So the risk is there on the face of the order, not as reinterpreted by Judge Orrick. We're talking about a factor of a thousandth, maybe $1 million for San Francisco rather than $1 billion at stake. So it's a very different situation.
Rachel Lagos.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of what we're hearing. Jessica said nobody's talking about Medicaid funding, but the administration's been a little bit unclear about what they're talking about. In the order, as Professor Levine noted, they made it very broad. In comments, Jeff Sessions and the president have, I think, mostly insinuated that this is aimed at pressure more than actually withholding funding, but they've also made some very, I think, threatening remarks. And then in court, the lawyer sort of tried to walk that back. And so I think that that was the basis of these lawsuits by the cities and counties was, we don't know what you're talking about. And if you take this to its extreme, it would be very harmful.
And let's hear from you on this, Jessica Vaughan, if we could.
Well, what they're talking about, the executive order told the Department of Justice and all federal agencies to look at federal grants that could possibly legitimately and reasonably be withheld from sanctuary jurisdictions. And, you know, what we're talking about here are discretionary grants. There's very established case law that grants that are made on a discretionary basis by the federal government, grants, not entitlements, can be withheld if jurisdictions are not meeting criteria that are established by the government. Sometimes
talking,
those criteria are established
excuse me,
by
Jessica,
Congress.
You're talking like about – I'm sorry, we're cross-talking here for a moment because I want to get on the record Medicare grants particularly because there was a ruling in 2012 by the Supreme Court on that, yeah?
that's more of an entitlement program. That's not a discretionary grant. It's also established that the grants, that this withholding of funds cannot be coercive, and that's generally taken to mean making up more than 20% of a jurisdiction's budget. So, you know, it's not a great mystery as to, you know, what the parameters are here. And I think we all know that federal grants have been withheld from schools and from jurisdictions in the past for all sorts of different purposes, whether it's, you know, to get jurisdictions to change the drinking age or to do other certain policies that are considered beneficial by the federal government. So it's not like this is, you know, some new approach here. And given the very severe public safety problems that are created when local jurisdictions release criminal aliens that ICE is trying to deport, there's a real federal interest in protecting the safety of everyone and also in protecting the federal government's ability to do its legitimate immigration enforcement mission. State
That's
and local
Jessica
government
Vaughn,
should
again,
not
with the
be
Center
able
for
to
Immigration Studies. I'm sorry, I'm going to break in here because we want to go back to our audience here. And let me get Kate in the audience who is waiting patiently to join us. Kate, go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks a lot. In the interest of post-election clarifying facts, I'm wondering who's in charge of making what an alien can be arrested for clear? Because it seems to be unclear to everybody. You know, the people here illegally don't know what they can be arrested for. They're, you know, I mean, who's at the top of ICE making these decisions? I mean, how can that information be clarified so that there's not this battle back and forth about what the actual truths are?
Hey, want to help us here, Marisa Lagos?
Well, I mean, you know, this is our system of democracy. A lot of this is up to interpretation, and that's
you
why
can tell from her voice, though, it's vexing to many people.
Yeah, and I mean, as we've seen different administrations interpret case law and other federal statute differently, as we've heard on this panel, we have, you know, people sort of looking at things and hearing things differently. Again, I think that to step back and sort of look at, I'm a political reporter, right? So when I look at the politics of this, I do think that as sort of chilling as some of this has been in California, the point that Sessions and Trump are probably trying to make is more symbolic in a way. They are trying to pressure jurisdictions to back off of these policies. They are trying to create an environment where it is not sort of attractive for folks like elected sheriffs, which we need to remember, right? Sheriffs are elected. They're politicians, too. They're not the same maybe as police chiefs or other other law enforcement officials. DAs are elected, too. And so, yeah, I don't think in this war of words that there are any simple answers because everybody sees things differently from where they're sitting.
Let me go to Supervisor Gioia, not on this, but on a comment from a listener, if you would. John Gioia, this is Mike who writes, and this is frequently what we hear from listeners also that causes vexation. Thousands of people from all around the world have applied for legal residence in the United States. They have filled out the forms, paid the freight, and have to wait to enter. Why should someone who enters illegally be allowed to usurp this peaceful immigration process?
Well, let me say, when we look at how we provide our services, and I'll take healthcare as an example, everybody's public health is improved when we are all healthier. So when we made a decision, and this was somewhat controversial, to expand health care to undocumented adults, and there were some people who made the same argument, said, why are we providing this service to someone who is here who, in an undocumented manner? Our response is because everybody in this county is healthier when more people get preventative health care services. So there's a larger public benefit. The cost to our health care system in the long term are less when people are getting preventative services. So that is why we didn't make a distinction as to whether you were your immigration status was not relevant, because public health is indeed public health for everybody.
Well, the listener's talking more about fairness, about equitable fairness.
But I think from a fairness standpoint, if you're a resident of this county and grew up here like myself, you receive receive a benefit when an undocumented family gets preventative health care. That's fair because it improves your health outcomes.
But it's not fair to the person who's trying to get into this country and can't get in under legal
circumstances. Well, I mean, that's a federal immigration policy. Our job is to deal with the issues and problems we have at a local level here in Contra Costa. Believe me, I think we need federal immigration reform. But ultimately, the mess in Congress hasn't been able to achieve that. And I just have to say, if the federal government invested as much money in opportunities for young people and after school and summer learning as they are trying to build a wall and go after undocumented, we'd be much more successful and have a lower crime rate. We would be safer. So I think I step back and say, if the federal government just shifts it where it's going to spend these enormous resources, we would have lower crime rates. We would have healthier communities. We would have a better place to live. So I think this is just misplaced, the whole policy of the administration.
And we have another caller. Ellen, join us. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm with the International Institute of the Bay Area. We provide immigration legal services in 6 counties across the Bay Area, including Contra Costa. I wanted to thank Supervisor Joya for his leadership on this issue and also just point out that the Southern Poverty Law Center has cited the Center for Immigration Studies as a hate group. So regardless of what sounds like reasonable points, I would just have the listeners keep that in mind.
All right. I thank you for that. And let me go back to Jessica Vaughn. Jessica Vaughn, I'd like to hear you weigh in again, if you would, on this.
Well, I think that the citizens of California could also just as legitimately ask local governments that, you know, if we did not provide services, make it possible for people who come into the country illegally to get jobs, then maybe more of those resources would be available to help not only American citizens, but legal immigrants who come here. There are more than 4 million people in the world who have qualified for legal immigration under our system. And it's not fair to them if we don't enforce the rules of our legal system and allow people to get those benefits and live here as if they were legally who came here illegally. So, there are winners and losers in immigration policy. And I think what it boils down to is, do we want to have policies that benefit American citizens and legal immigrants, or do we want to adopt policies that benefit mainly illegal immigrants? And that's a choice that localities are welcome to make, but it's also reasonable for voters to hold them accountable for that and for the federal government to perhaps impose consequences for adopting policies that interfere with a legitimate federal enforcement mission.
All right, I want to read a tweet here from a listener. It says, we have citizen students who don't look Euro-American or fear being taken by ICE because they don't have proof of their age and status. And Tom writes, basically a sanctuary city is just not allowing its police and other services to be appropriated by ICE. That's not ignoring or breaking laws. It's a local right to not have local funds appropriated by the federal government. Is this a states' right fight, Professor Levine,
Part
for
of it
some
is,
people?
Absolutely. Sure it is. It's this question. A lot of what we're hearing right now are policy differences, and part of the genius of the federal system is that different places can come to different decisions on some of these issues. Now, certainly some are at the federal level, and what we need is a Congress who can put together a fair immigration policy that takes account for the millions of people that are here, plus the people who, as the caller said, have stood in line and played by the rules. That seems unlikely in this Congress, but every once in a while there's a little glimmer, but that's the real solution, is it has to be in Congress.
And,
go ahead.
Oh, I just think it's interesting. Two of the cases that immigrant rights advocates who have helped draft a lot of these so-called sanctuary policies are relying on are actually cases that were brought against the Obama administration by red states. So the sort of federalism is being flipped on its head. One of them was Obamacare, and one of them was around gun control. And so I think that's sort of an interesting note. I also think it's important to note that we're not hearing a lot of debate actually about the issue of whether law enforcement should be, say, participating in raids or what happens in the community. A lot of where the rubber meets the road in this fight with the feds is what happens in jails. What happens once someone is suspected and arrested of a crime? Should they, without going through the whole criminal justice process, be handed over to ICE before maybe that case is adjudicated or if the charges are dropped? So I just think that's, you know, an important...
We've got one more caller here I want to get on quickly with the comments. If you could, BK, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm an immigrant from India, and I take serious objection for you to you guys calling us all immigrants and clubbing us with the illegal immigrants. This is an acceptance of illegality by indoctrination. I don't. It's like saying a bank robber is a bank borrower. You know, I'm a borrower and he's a robber, but we both take money from the bank, so we all become borrowers.
Well, we're back to that distinction again, Supervisor Joya.
So how do you distinguish? There are many families here in California and in our county where the children are. I don't want to use the term legal. Are documented and their parents are not. So how do you classify them? I mean, the idea here is that when people live here, you know, speaking at the local level, our job is to understand how to make our community safer and better places to live, and that means providing services to people who may not be documented, and that improves, again, everybody's quality of life. So, look, there needs to be sane immigration reform at the federal level, but that's not an issue that we're dealing with locally.
We've
our
got
job
seconds
is
left. I have to ask you, what does this mean for Richmond in terms of the lawsuit?
So my understanding, and I know the chief of staff of the mayor is here in the audience, is that Richmond's lawsuit is very, very similar to the Santa Clara and San Francisco lawsuits. It was just a timing issue, so it is more likely than not that the court would probably reach the same outcome in the Richmond case.
Let me thank all of our panelists here and, of course, thank our live audience. Marisa Lagos, again, is a reporter with KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. David Levine, law professor at UC Hastings. John Joya, whom you just heard from, Contra Costa County Supervisor, who, again, is backing a proposal to make Contra Costa a sanctuary county. And Jessica Vaughn, who joined us by phone from Franklin, Massachusetts, with the Center for Immigration Studies, critical of sanctuary policies. Again, to follow along with today's conversation on Twitter, simply use the hashtag ForumCCC. We are coming up on another hour. In the hour ahead, we're going to meet some veterans who are back at college and talk about that difficult, sometimes difficult transition between coming away from being deployed and going into the classroom, and also hear their stories. And also, we're going to hear from some people who are all about a renaissance in Richmond. We're going to have some entertainment as well. Stay tuned. Another hour of Forum up ahead. Thank you all for being here. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Costa.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.